This is Asia Rising, the podcast of La Trobe Asia, where we discuss the news, views, and general happenings of Asian states and societies. The podcast you're about to hear was recorded in front of a live audience. The speakers are Professor Nick Bisley, Executive Director of La Trobe Asia, and John Garno, journalist and Asia editor at Fairfax. The topic was Turnbull's Asia, exploring the new prime ministership of Malcolm Turnbull and speculating on how he's going to approach Asia. It was recorded in front of a live audience at the La Trobe Asia Research Showcase on the 11th of November, 2016.
Thanks, John, for making the time from a very busy schedule in the world of newspapers. I know it's always uncertain as to quite what the demands of your time are, and we're very grateful for you to be here. So thanks.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
All righty. So we will now sit. I was hoping for a dais so we could sit above you in true kind of hierarchical fashion. But I'll chair, comfortable. So, I've just got my... Oops.
What's it going? Wide. We're good.
Sound is working. Okay. Probably the best thing is to start with the basics about Turnbull. And just wondering, when you're thinking about Prime Minister Turnbull and his handling of foreign policy, what attributes does he bring that are particular to how he may approach Australia's sort of policy towards the region?
Look, he's an extraordinary character. Everybody knows that, whatever you think of him. So first of all, he brings an extraordinary confidence to the job, bordering on, many would say, arrogance. He is extremely erudite. He's well-read. He's got real business experience. He's got real family experience, I think. Very similar to Rudd, actually, in that, you know, his life has genuinely been lived in Asia. His son has married a Chinese lady. He's done a lot of business in China himself. He's travelled all around the region. So he's every bit the cosmopolitan, contemporary Australian reader. Very similar, I think, in mindset to Rudd in that respect, but from a more entrepreneurial background. He doesn't really necessarily have a China specialist focus. It's more regional, but if he was going to pick out one country where he would claim to have experience, I think it's China. So all of that coupled with his confidence means for at least a great change of tone in dealing with the region. And I would also say that the fact that he can talk, he's one of the most articulate leaders Australia's ever had, makes a big difference too, because one of my great criticisms of prime ministers over, many years actually, or 20 years basically, is that none of them have been prepared to talk about Australia's place in the world. Like, there's a lot that's changing, there's a lot that's happening in Asia, and here is a guy who does not lack confidence in being able to talk about the issues.
Now, under Abbott's prime ministership, foreign policy was really heavily driven out of the PM's office and very heavily influenced by, I think, Abbott's instincts on the one hand and the slightly Svengali figure of Andrew Shearer, sort of hairy-chested, muscular Australian foreign policy kind of vision. Do you think Turnbull's going to continue? And that's actually, it's a slight caricature, but it's actually a long trend in Australian foreign policy where the PM's office has been really kind of in control of things for a long period of time, really since Evans, I think. Since Evans' departure, rather. Do you think Turnbull's likely to continue that, or do you think he might delegate a bit more and give Julie Bishop and the department a bit more of a free head in sort of shaping Australian foreign policy?
On that, I don't think he has any choice. So he is a very different... Most prime ministers have insisted on having a very, very prominent role in shaping foreign policy. They have led the... insisted on leading the field. Bishop was different, but certainly Rudd, certainly Howard... Keating, and I'd say even Hawke, well, subject to Gareth Evans, they played it was led from the top. Turnbull comes into a very different situation in the sense that Bishop is the power figure in his cabinet. He has to defer to her as a matter of, as his first instinct, it has to be to defer to what the foreign minister thinks. And secondly, she's almost alone in that cabinet. She's got a record of competence. And the fact that she has been seen to do a very good job in the field means that naturally a new prime minister will defer to her judgment. So she does, at the moment, own the space. Despite everything I said about Turnbull's background and his confidence, I don't really get the sense that he spent much of the first 7 weeks trying to change Australia's foreign policy. That will change this week, as suddenly he's forced to confront, well, you know, he's travelling the whole world in 18 days, in the next 3 weeks, all around the world. All kinds of cabinet meetings and National Security Committee meetings will be going on this week. But up until now, we haven't seen any substantive shift in Australian foreign policy, a huge shift in tone. And you were talking about Andrew Shearer. And look, he is an interesting character, and I think sometimes unfairly maligned. For those who don't know, he was the National Security Advisor in Abbott's office, famously on the neocon side of policy. And I don't call him a neocon, I'm just saying he's on that side. But different in Abbott too, he was actually still a constructive force with Abbott in some ways, in the fact, you know, he's not an Anglophile. Abbott was until the very day he took office. Shearer is an Asianist. It's just, you know, politically, he has a very deep distrust of Chinese political system. He has a very deep fondness for Japan. That's really Japan, one of Shearer's defining traits, which Abbott inherited from him, I think. And he does believe in strong, muscular American leadership and Australian support for that. So the tone of that will all change. There won't be a shred of the Abbott Anglophile sensibility anymore. And we've already lost the entire sort of the khaki cladding of government. It won't be, you know, even though underlying policy hasn't changed at all yet, there's been none of the photo ops in front of, you know, on top of tanks and with ASIO kind of meeting and beating up sort of Muslim communities and stuff like that. That's all completely changed already. And I think we're, at the moment, we're about to get into the really hard stuff of, okay, what is the underlying policies and strategic framework that we need to alter? I don't think that conversation has really begun.
Yeah, Julie Bishop, I think I jokingly once described her as Kim Jong-Julie and her ability to be deputy leader of the Liberal Party for life, her capacity to see off leaders is quite remarkable. But I'll just press you a little bit on the role of the PM's office, particularly Frances Adamson, who you probably know quite well from her time as Australian ambassador to China, has recently been named as basically Shearer's successor as the sort of foreign policy supremo in the PM's office. Do you think that, worked with her and more generally, do you think that's going to shape, how do you see her attributes?
I think it's such a sensible appointment. I mean, I was on the other side of Frances, and she's a consummate professional, you know, so professional that almost impossible for a journalist to get any meaningful information from her. But I think she's a huge asset and a completely different style to Shearer. Shearer was all about, okay, how can we push, change things, manage the crisis of the moment. Frances is a manager in the true sense of the word. She knows how to use her staff. She knows how to use the departments. She's helped because she's got a very stable DFAT with Foreign Minister Julie Bishop. She's also helped because she's now got a very strong Prime Minister and Cabinet led by Michael Thorley, who's got very strong foreign policy and security experience herself. Frances Adamson herself is not a security background, but she spent a couple of years running Stephen Smith's office when he was defence minister. So she's across, you know, she's across the whole brief. She's a China specialist now, spent time in Taiwan as well as Beijing. I think that what that means is we've probably for the first time in 7 or 8 years, we're entering an accident-free zone. There's going to be
famous last words.
It's going to be much less. Abbott and Rudd both started with rolling accidents in the first months of their prime ministership, as they were surprised by the extent of China. You know, the China would wrong foot them at every step. That's not going to happen so obviously and so evidently under Frances. But I don't think she necessarily is somebody who steamrolls her own views through government. So it won't, initially at least, be a Turnbull-led foreign policy.
I think the first time we saw Turnbull say anything meaningful about foreign policy was during an interview he gave on the 7:30 Report about a month ago now, I think, in which he said things that even Abbott had been cautious about not saying and reflected you know, said that, I think, I can't remember the exact phrase, but I think China was pushing the envelope in what it was doing in the South China Sea, and that China's rise requires balancing against it. And I think a lot of people, you know, in the instant punditry that occurred after the handover, there was all of this, oh, China's, you know, the Turnbull's child married a Chinese person, business ties to China, ergo much more moderate line on China, whereas what we saw in that speech was not too much. Where do you see the relationship with China going, particularly given you've got Francis in the office plus Turnbull sort of background?
Yeah. What did you think? Were you surprised by that interview?
Yeah, I was really surprised by the language. I mean, it was before Francis was appointed.
Yeah.
But I think my view is, I think this is, it's helpful in the sense that one of the most useful things that that I think Shearer brought to Australian policy on Asia, and particularly to China, was a clarity about where Australia stood.
Yep.
And I think Labor had been quite unhelpful in trying to make things ambiguous and muddy the water. And I think that lack of clarity around where Australia stood
was
unhelpful.
So we had two policies, particularly on China, but China is basically the pole star for strategic policy these days. And we had what was going on in Canberra, which was very much about, hang on, we're pretty worried about what's going on in Beijing. We're worried about all these periphery militarist sort of activities. And so it was all a full front, it was evolving to a full frontal hedging strategy in defence, in the intelligence agencies, and also by the end in the Department of Foreign Affairs. But you know, above the parapet, publicly, you'd get none of this. There was the Asian century was all about prosperity. China was all about bringing money in, and the kind of, you know, as if the politics didn't matter. So what the Abbott Shearer has succeeded in doing is at least connecting those two, what had been parallel universes, the security and the economics. You can now talk about the security side of things. With Turnbull, you know, I think people were just projecting all sorts of fantasies onto who he was going to be. He was going to be this, whether you thought you should be tough on China or you thought that we needed to accommodate with China, people expected Turnbull to have a to accommodate China. There were certainly people who thought that for all the reasons you described, that he knew China, therefore would be close to it. Other people thought he'd been sort of bought by China and therefore would be inappropriately close to China. It was all, you know, I don't think it was ever going to be the case, essentially because the underlying continuity of Australian strategic policy is very strong. The currents are that, hang on, there's a really big, serious thing to worry about. It does have security implications. It's certainly got economic implications, but it's impossible for a prime minister to walk into that job, and if he's got any intelligence at all, any advice, to ignore the strategic dimensions of what's going on. With Turnbull, I think he's been going through a steep learning curve. I think he's been surprised by China's activities in the last couple of years. His public comments on the 7:30 report, he said similar things in public before in speeches, certainly last year at ANU. It was probably the first time. And the language he used was quite carefully couched. He didn't actually say we should balance against China. He was saying it's the inevitable result. You know, far be it for me to say what should be happening, but it's just the inevitable result of China's activities produces an equal and opposite balancing reaction. So, like you, I was very impressed that he dared to speak about it. I wasn't particularly surprised by the position that he showed, but it was definitely a break from the past.
It made clear, I think, where he's going. I guess that then links to the sort of the other big question: if we've got China is there, and we've got a sense of in many ways, a kind of continuity in the underlying approach from the Abbott government, if a shift in the language around it and the optics, if you like.
Yeah.
It sounds, therefore, that it's probably likely to expect something similar with regard to the US, and particularly given how much and how bipartisan, in some respects, the commitment in Australia that Australia has to this sort of, not just to the US alliance, but to the vision the US has for the region as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, with some exceptions. I mean, there's probably never been an Australian government that was so frontally opposed to a key US objective, and that's the Obama administration's climate change policy. So in some ways, we're naturally more aligned with the current Washington view of the world than we were 8 weeks ago. So Turnbull will start, no doubt, will start more skeptical of the military-first approach. He may conclude that there's no other options. He certainly would be loath to change policy direction unless he's got a pretty good justification and can play it out in sensible ways. But he is not an all the way with USA kind of guy. But I would argue that neither have previous prime ministers. You know, it's been underestimated the extent to which Australia's been prepared to push against American interest, for better and for worse, depending on your views.
The other major power, I mean, you touched on Shearer earlier and Shearer's approach to Japan. I think probably the one policy development, if you like, under the Abbott government, which was probably the most unexpected, was the extent to which Australia kind of cleaved to Abe in many ways. And it's and Turnbull has announced, his office has announced, that he'll be going there in a few weeks' time as a separate, separate from the summit speed dating diplomacy that's about to happen. And the Australia-Japan relationship was massively strengthened, regardless of your views of it, but massively strengthened by the personal link between Abe and Abbott. And certainly the language out of Tokyo when he was dumped was one of absolute shock and uncertainty what this is going to mean. And it's not just the submarines, although the submarines is a pretty important part of it. Do you think Turnbull is going to continue this closeness to Japan, or do you think we'll sort of go back to where we have been? Because there has been a kind of bipartisan approach to Japan for a while. It's just Turnbull kind of dialed it up to
Abbott
12. Abbott dialed it up to 12, yeah.
Look, again, I think if you... I'd slightly question the premise of the question, and I think the continuity in Japan engagement is really strong too, particularly under Gillard, where the Gillard's response to the tsunami, what was that, 4 years ago now?
March 2011.
I should remember because I do remember it. she was the first leader to turn up, and it was a very passionate personal response. She really laid the groundwork for the security cooperation we're seeing now. Stephen Smith laid the groundwork for this submarine program. So all of this stuff was happening, but at a much more quiet level. What Abbott did is he superimposed, his personal chumminess with Abe, and B, his foot and mouth kind of disease, where he kept on overstating the case in really inopportune moments. And so if you strip away his excessive language on three or four occasions, I would argue that actually what we saw with Japan and Australia was more continuity than disjunction under Abbott. And Turnbull has, I think that's a really, really important signal of him going to Japan, precisely for the reasons you're talking about. He is a guy that's 7 weeks into government. He's going to be in about a dozen capitals. He has to be in a dozen capitals, around the world over the next few weeks. And he's chosen to straight after that back up and go to Japan, as opposed to some other possibilities. It's a huge statement of continuity, I think, but also laying the case for a genuine process to be done on this submarine auction. There's a lot of money involved. Australia can't afford Japan to believe that it owns the tender process. It has to have at least a credible tendering process, but he's laying the foundation to be able to make a decision on its merits, I think.
And finally, just want to leave some time for people to weigh in. We sort of talked about the major power relationships. The final one to think about is the country about which we sort of know least in terms of what Turnbull thinks, and it's the one where it has been, we feel like the past 12 or 18 months has seen the greatest acceleration, and that is the bilateral relationship with India. And of course, we saw again a sort of a personal chemistry between Modi and Abbott, although Modi seems to have personal chemistry with just about everyone. Everyone gets a hug with Modi these days.
And a personal speech.
But nonetheless, 2014 was a big year in Australia-India relations. The bilateral PM visits, just the most obvious part of a long effort by governments on both sides, particularly by Australia, to make India more, a more important part of Australia's Asia policy. But we don't, you know, India's, just, yeah, I don't think Turnbull's ever been to India.
Really?
Yeah, I'm pretty confident of that. Put a footnote on that one.
Oh, I'd be amazed. That's a story.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah. I only say this because the Australia India Institute board, of which I have the dubious pleasure of serving, is very keen to get him to go because they are pretty sure he hasn't been. And seeing as bulk of the funding, Matt might be able to cut this, the bulk of the funding comes from the PM's office, so they have vested interest in doing this. But so short question, how do you think Turnbull's going to approach India? More continuity?
I'm surprised to hear he hasn't gone. Now, in that broad sort of Asia canvas that I tried to describe before, I would have thought his instincts would be, you know, let's do something with India. It's underdone. That's one Abbott legacy he'd be very, very pleased to continue. That said, there's no evidence of that at the moment. There was a great hope, if not expectation. Abbott would have visited in December. And Abbott would have used that as an opportunity to try and get this crazily kind of accelerated free trade agreement negotiated and signed. Without a prime ministerial visit in December, there's no way you can get the Indian bureaucracy to do anything. So that doesn't look like it's happening. I would have thought it's Japan or India. He's chosen Japan. So it has, you know, it hasn't been Turnbull's top priority yet. I'd be surprised if he doesn't try to redeem or to put new energy into India, because it makes so much sense on so many levels, including his personal background.
Yeah, and there's been, you know, as with a lot of aspects of Australia's Asian policy, a lot of bipartisanship in recent years. Yeah. You know, both parties have spent a lot of time at a range of levels, not only the prime ministerial, but a whole range of levels.
Yeah. Yeah, the underlying economic and strategic pulls and pushes are very strong.
And as is not, wouldn't surprise anyone who watches India closely, the economic partnership agreement, which I think is the term they use to describe it, is negotiations are moving more slowly than expected, which is hardly surprising. So we've got 15, 20 minutes or so to take questions, comments, thoughts. The only thing if you just bear with this, I'll have to sort of repeat or quickly summarise your questions for the sake of the recording, just so it makes some sense to those listening in. So with that, the floor is yours. Robin.
John, your view of the TPP, China Free Trade Agreement, Andrew Robb and Peter Burgess are striking it even harder this week, I think.
Yeah.
What's your view? Is it going to bring in workers who will undercut?
You mean the China Free Trade Agreement?
Okay, so just the question's just about...
What does John think of the China?
John Garnaut's assessment of the Australia-China Free Trade Agreement.
Oh, I think Peter Varghese is exactly right. You know, it's the most unexpectedly kind of exceptional agreement that Australia could possibly have secured with a single country. It's huge, which doesn't mean that it's going to necessarily result in all these amazing benefits, but they've opened the door to that possibility. I can't for the life of me see... I don't think it could ever have been seriously considered that Labor would try to seriously block this thing. I think the Labor migration concerns are way overdone, and that's my own personal experience of these issues. I think that the whole issue was really a face-saving gesture for Chinese state-owned enterprises who had burned billions of dollars in the Pilbara. They had to go back to Beijing, explain themselves. It wasn't because we didn't do any due diligence. It wasn't that we didn't understand local environmental laws, labour conditions. You know, nobody told us we couldn't import 10,000 cut price workers to the Pilbara. And that's the story they told in Beijing. That then got kind of echoed back into the world as, you know, China's upset about Australia's discrimination against. And now we've got a face-saving clause in a couple of clauses in the China FTA to represent that historical problem that they had. I can't for the life of me think that that's going to be a massive bridge to seriously change the Australian labour market. So it's a storm in a teacup. It's a terrific agreement as far as these bilateral agreements go. And you know, let's go and see if they can actually implement the thing.
If I can do some product placement, the FTAs are always wildly oversold by their supporters and wildly undersold or criticised by their critics. And the reality of the economic reality of the bilateral trade agreements that have been negotiated in Asia over the past 10, 12 years has been massively underwhelming. And the Australian Journal of International Affairs, which I happen to edit, has just issued a special issue looking at 10 years of the US-Australia Free Trade Agreement.
Great.
Really good analysis, both political and economic.
Who's on it?
Anne Kapling, John Ravenhill, Sharon Armstrong, Mike I was about to call him Mark Wesley, Michael Wesley, a few other people. It's really, it's a really, really good set of papers, and guest editor, I should point out, by Liz Thurbin from UNSW. What has shaped the Australia-US trade relationship over the past 10 years? Tariff cuts? Nope. Currency, of which had nothing to do with.
So if the US FTA is, you know, of value of roughly zero on an optimistic.
Well, it's not zero, but it's sort of, you know, it's.
Well, you add it all up, including concessions made on pharmaceuticals and IP. I'd say net zero. The China FTA is substantially north of that.
All right. Sorry, yeah, the back. So the question is just about the what are the most exciting, challenging, thrilling, concerning aspects of journalism in China?
Yeah. Look, there's not much to excite you at the moment. One of the great thrills about me doing my job in China when I was there, where there were so many really professional, quality Chinese journalists doing what they could under incredibly difficult conditions. Now I'd have to say that I can't see very many of them who are even managing to do that. The last 2 years has been really grim, without exception, for journalists in China, Chinese journalists in China, also harder for foreign correspondents. You know, some organisations that are somehow still managing to produce some sort of independence, some sort of quality, independent quality, but it really is the exception at the moment. It's grim.
I know there's been a whole lot of journalism programs
started in China. Yeah, but when journalism is explicitly defined as furthering the interests of the ruling party of the day, it makes it difficult.
So, Jim,
John, you've been back, I think, about 2 years from China. I wonder, in the time you come back, whether you've seen any difference in the attitudes of Australians towards China. Obviously, you came back and forth in your time in Beijing, but you've seen a kind of growing xenophobia, an attempt to try to understand China, or are we more continuity than change here?
So the question is just about the extent to which over the since John's been back in Australia, attitudes to China have hardened.
Look, the single biggest surprise for me coming back was, I'll give you one example. I was talking to a bunch of financial heads, chief economists and all these dudes, and I was on a panel, and there was the guy from, I don't know, let's pick a bank, say ANZ, and another guy from some, look, I won't name him, but prominent financial people, and there's telling the story of China, which just did not even intersect with the empirical experience that I'd had. You know, that China was on this inexorable reform process of growth and reform, and the only financial market that's going to matter to the world, certainly to Australia, is China in 10 years' time, and they have these not straight lines but exponential lines going up the graph like that. And I gave a different view, and I said, well, look, we haven't actually seen any evidence of this reform program, and the sort of reform program you're talking about is necessarily one in which the party agrees or is forced to take a much reduced role in society, to relinquish control or its option for control over whole realms of economic institutions and decision making. And afterwards, you know, she was, oh, that's really interesting hearing the bearish case of China, you know, like I was the outrider in that group. There was one prominent Chinese economist who I invited along, and afterwards he said, you know, that was a really balanced view that you gave. So what I was saying about China made perfect sense to Chinese people in China, you know, and you could always have a conversation. But in Australia, the people were, for whatever reason, they've been drinking this Kool-Aid that was going to be, you know, absolutely, politics was irrelevant to China's economic trajectory, and it was run by such sensible meritocratic people in this apolitical environment that, of course, all the right decisions would be made. So that's actually been the hardest thing about going back, is having a conversation which is dominated by people who are either deluding themselves or deluding others for their own business interests. And I'd actually include a lot of the university management in this process as well. China is the big customer. So that was actually difficult. How do you have a conversation when I can't even find the point of intersection with reality? That's all changed since the stock market fiasco, and there's been a much more realistic look at at the intersection of economics and politics in China. While I've been there, there's also been that slightly ugly housing debate. I think it was just an example of what happens when there's a political vacuum, when politicians refuse to lead. Well, people have concerns. You know, there are legitimate concerns, but there's been no leadership on that debate. So there's a few worrying things, a little bit of reality creeping in. But still people are interested. Everybody still is interested in working out what's going on in China.
Yeah, John, I just wanted to ask, sort of follow that up. Mm. Linda Jakobsen, who you and I know well, and she's very kindly serves on the Trobe Asia Advisory Board. You know, her view is that the debate in Australia is very polarised between the sort of the kind of Kool-Aid drinkers, as you colourfully describe them, and the sort of super hawks on the other end, which is, and that there's the ability to sort of, whether it's intersect the empirics or just take a nuanced position in the middle is very, very difficult to do. Do you sort of accept that proposition?
I mean, that's another version of the parallel government positions that we talked about, where the underlying security bureaucracies and foreign policy bureaucracies are having one set of conversations and not even connecting with the treasury, the economic, the business conversation. That's true. I think one positive legacy of the Abbott era is starting to connect those conversations. So that's true, but not as true as it was 2 years ago.
All right. Who else? Go on.
Let me ask you a question.
All right.
Yeah?
That's not the deal.
What do you think is going to be the defining foreign policy input of Turnbull?
Sophistication and nuance, I think. He's a guy who... He's got a team around him who are capable of playing complex games in a sophisticated way. And I think that was the real... I think neither side, since Howard was in government, has been able to do more than one thing at a time and sell different messages. I think the caricature, which is, I think, has a grain of truth in it about Labor, was, they'd go to Washington and tell the Americans what they want to hear, go to Tokyo, tell the Japanese what they want to hear, and so on, and then expect everyone not to be looking at what they do and be counterproductive. Mm. Abbott, I think, had a tendency, not just the foot in mouth, but I think the way in which they approached it, in which it was strategy first and everything else second, and the economic policy was very much about the strategy in many respects. That I think also reflected that kind of tendency for a one-dimensional single-track approach. Whereas I think with Turnbull and his team, and I think he's got, as you said, in not just in his office and the relations between the key parts of the office, but at the pointy ends of Department of Defense, Treasury, Foreign Affairs, really sharp people.
Yep.
And it's actually almost serendipitous, but there's a really good group of people in Dennis Richardson, Peter Varghese. Mm. I've just gone blank on the Treasury's head.
Oh, I'll challenge you to come up with a sensible name from Treasury.
Yeah, maybe not. But anyway, I think at this stage, that would be my punt, an ability to play a complex strategic game.
Hmm.
The problem is the challenge will be events. Things will happen, and we will always, by definition, be reactive to those.
Yeah.
And our ability, and I think the other thing that's going to make life slightly tricky. Is that because Australia is so heavily invested in American strategic policy that our room for manoeuvre will always be a little bit constrained.
Mm.
But I think the capacity for Australia to carve out space for itself and to follow what John McCarthy and a bunch of other sort of very eminent figures have been saying is Australian policy needs to reflect Australian interests, not American interests, which is, again, slightly caricaturing, but I think that tendency has prevailed.
Where would that actually manifest? Where do you see a contradiction of interests there in our region?
Now?
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything yet really clear, but I think the two maritime crises are probably the obvious ones where I think recently, both in the East China Sea and the South China Sea, Australia has tended to... and particularly under Abbott, but has made a more visible contribution than is necessary to help either Australia or the crises, partly out of this sense that we need to be seen to be or want to be seen to be supporting the American line.
Yeah.
I think partly also the American position in relation to those two crises has not been especially clear or good, particularly in the South China Sea in recent months. But I think that's, so I think events, how events play out, you always have these surprises that come along, and predicting how they, how and what they might be, is by definition, I think, is impossible. But I think that that reactive quality and the extent to which Australia is constrained by its relationship with the US and the sort of side effects that that has, if you think about the India relationship, for example, for a long period of time, the nature of Australia's relationship with the US made improving relations with India difficult. And Meg Gurry, who's the Latrobe Asia fellow, wrote a great, the best history of Australia-India relations, diplomatic relations, has a great anecdote in it where Sir Arthur Tang was greeted by his, who was then the High Commissioner, greeted by the Foreign Minister, whose name I've suddenly forgotten. Can remember it is, Robin? Anyway, who would say, "Ah, Sir Arthur, what have you done for the Americans today?" That sort of that sort of story. So I think that sort of side cost that you often sort of tend not to think about and only think about, the narrow kind of choices you may or may not have to make in any given moment, I think tend to get underplayed. And they will be there. But I think the ability that, my sense is the ability of the Turnbull government to manage those will be a greater level of sophistication and capacity to play a more complex game.
I couldn't agree more on sophistication, nuance, and complexity. But
don't talk about the people.
And all of your points about Canberra has a very strong bureaucracy at the moment, with the exception of Treasury. But where I disagree with is on the East China Sea and the South China Sea. I just don't see America pulling Australia into this. I think Australia was yelling at America to be more focused, to be clearer, and sees it's very much in its own interests to have certainly a strong, consistent American presence, but more importantly, and this is where Australia's been very proactive, a more consistent regional voice, bringing in all these other Southeast Asians and also India into the conversation. So I really just don't see that there's any, at the moment, conflict of interest between the US and Australia yet.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. I think that's the case. But I think you can play the clock forward and see situations in which Australia, because of its relationship with the US, will have to do some careful diplomacy to manage, if things play out in a certain way, to manage that relationship, particularly if what the US decides to do is say, we need lots of flags to embarrass China. We need to show China that's out of line, and we need to get lots of people to line up behind us publicly to say, and they've been doing, beginning to do this with the South China Sea. They've been publicly putting pressure on the Koreans to come out and sort of say something against Beijing, which it doesn't want to do.
Which it did just a week or two ago for the first time.
Yeah, but it really didn't want to do. Okay, sorry, Nicola, and then we probably should stop. Oh, no. No, he's telling me to wrap things up, so ignore him. Yeah,
okay,
of course you do.
Look, for far as I can tell, every Australian government has been quietly, sort of desperately trying to get Japan to strike a different tone on that without saying anything publicly. I'm sure that won't change.
Yeah, and the American government has too. I mean, if you talk to the people in the US government about this, and particularly when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, they would say, and in fact, the Americans were not publicly saying, you need to change the language. These are not comfort women. These were sex slaves. And that's difficult. Has been very, very difficult. And it's not, I think under Abe, you're not going to see that change.
Yeah, so South Korea, I think, is a really interesting test case because it's against the trend of the rest of East, every other maritime country in East Asia has drawn back from China as it's got more and more worried about the security equation. South Korea is the exception, but I wonder if that's not changing now because it might have just been a response to Xi Jinping putting unprecedented modern pressure on the North Korean regime. That's now changed, and we've already seen instantly a change in South Korea's posture towards the American security positions.
All right, we've probably got time for one quick one at the front here.
Given that climate change and advocacy for carbon market has been kind of one of the defining moments for Turnbull's career, and that Australia's reasoning for holding back on that was international inaction. Do you think China's beginning to roll out a national carbon trading market next year is going to put any pressure on Turnbull to kind of revert back to his publicly stated
opinions? Yeah.
So the question is just about the extent to which China's approach to carbon, and particularly carbon markets, is going to put pressure on Australia to follow suit.
Yeah, if we can break that into two parts, and one is China. Look, China has been making enormous policy strides for five years really, to reduce its carbon footprint purely as a side product of trying to reduce the pollution problem in China. So that is continuous, and the carbon market, the trading scheme, I'm not personally particularly excited about, because this is a country that has trouble putting a stock market together, let alone something more abstract like a carbon market. You just can't really do it without institutions to hold them. That said, China's very serious, Turnbull's very serious, so you put all that together, the international tailwinds are very strong, so Turnbull has to be the guy that claims no credit for doing a lot underwater, you know, a lot sort of having his legs moving frantically to improve Australia's position in this whole debate and play a constructive role in the world without giving the public, without publicly saying so.
All right, I think we must end things there, unfortunately, but we have morning tea waiting for you somewhere out there. But please join me in thanking John for an absolutely fantastic discussion.
Thanks, Nick.
That's Professor Nick Bisley in conversation with John Garnaut. You've been listening to Asia Rising, the podcast of La Trobe Asia. You can subscribe to it in iTunes and on SoundCloud. Please leave a review there and tell your friends about it. You can follow both Nick Bisley and John Garnaut on Twitter. Nick is at Nick Bisley and John is at J Garnaut. That's J-G-A-R-N-A-U-T. Thanks for listening.